Session number 16757, reel 1.
Norman Pickles, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Todmorden, West Yorkshire.
Which year was this?
1918.
What did your father do for a living?
Well, at the time of the... just before the war, he was a foreman in the corporation, Todmorden Corporation.
Did you go to school in Todmorden?
Yeah, went to grammar school. Well, it was secondary modern at that time.
How old were you when you finished schooling?
14.
Did you get a job?
Yeah, I went straight into an office.
Were you doing that type of thing when war broke out?
Yes.
Did you hear Chamberlain's broadcast declaring war on Germany?
Yes.
What did you feel about it?
Well, I was quite pleased, actually, because it meant I could go into the Navy. My father was against me going into the Navy because he'd been in the First World War, and he didn't encourage me to join until... And then when war broke out, I said, good, I'm in. I'll soon be in anyway.
What was your father's objection to the Navy?
He'd been in the Navy from about 1916. Before that, he was in the Army Territorials and he'd served in the Dardanelles, and then he came out of the Army and went into the Navy. And just before I was born, he was at Zeebrugge, at the raid on Zeebrugge. And he came home on leave to see me, newly born. And in later years, whilst he spoke about the Navy, he didn't think it was a career at all. He didn't think there was anything in it for me.
So...
discouraged me from joining him.
So what did you do after the war declaration?
Well, that was a Sunday morning, and the following Saturday, I went to Preston to join up. Preston was the nearest... well, Blackburn was the nearest recruiting office, but it was close, so I came into Preston to join up and saw the naval section there. There was a joint recruiting office. Saw the naval section, and the chief there said, well, we haven't got ourselves down to HO, hostilities only, engagements yet. The only thing you can join up in at the moment in your job, you could join up as a writer for 12 years. But I didn't think much of that. I didn't want to go as a writer anyway. I'd set my mind on being a telegraphist. So I went home, and I next went to the local labour exchange, and he said, well, the only thing you can do, really, he said, is wait until you get your calling up papers. I registered, I was 21 then, registered, and within a couple of months, I was called up and went to Leeds for a medical. And I was actually joined the Navy, called up into the Navy on the 23rd of January 1940, HMS Victory at Portsmouth.
What kind of training did you have?
As a telegraphist, it was a 6 months period, 6 months training, from January to July. Okay. I only joined joining procedure at HMS Victory. They then sent us across Portsmouth Harbour to Gosport, and we did 5 months of our training in HMS St Vincent at Gosport, and the last month was done at HMS Collingwood up at Fareham. They'd opened that as a new signals place.
What did you think of the training that you got?
It was very good. I've got the service certificate there, and I passed. That was the main thing. Yes, I lapped it all up. I was in it, you know. I lapped it all up, and all the discipline and the routine and everything just fell into place as I expected it would.
Which ship did you first go to sea in?
St. Elston, escort trawler. When I was ready for going to sea, they were short of telegraphists, and they sent 50 of us to Chatham to wait ships for draft. And I got drafted to St. Elston.
So it was HMS, was it?
HMS St. Elston, yes. An escort, ocean escort trawler, ASDIC trawler, anti-submarine trawler.
What impression did the ship first make on you?
The ship? First?
First make on you?
Well, again, I was quite pleased because it was... I'd said to my mates, they were talking about going in battleships and cruisers and so on, and I said, give me a little trawler and I'll be quite happy, so long as it's going to sea. And so I was very happy because I was the only telegraphist on board at that time, and the ship was lying in Belfast Dock, joined her. And 3 days later, we went across to the Clyde and... then took a convoy to Iceland, up to Reykjavik. But I liked that because I was the only wireless operator. I had a little cabin in the wireless office, just like it had been in peacetime. I had a bunk and cabin in the wireless office.
How did the crew and officers get on with each other?
Very well. There was no sort of ill feeling or anything like that about. Everybody got on very well, and they were, a lot of them were old fishermen that they soon showed me the ropes, you know, how to the routine was and so on.
Which fishing ports did they mostly come from?
Mainly from Hull and Grimsby. And the ship was a hull ship. The St. Elston was a hull ship. None from Fleetwood. Although I now live near Fleetwood, I never met anybody from Fleetwood in the Navy.
So the first job that the ship had when you joined it was to go to Iceland in convoy.
Right. That's right.
What was that like?
What
was it like?
Well, to me, it was like the first one I'd done, but it turned out as I expected it would. We left Iceland, and we only had trawlers doing this job at this time. So early in the war, there were no corvettes that had come into being at that time. And so we might have an old destroyer leading us at the front. There were... Sardonyx, Skate, Shikari, some old S-class destroyers, and sometimes we'd have one of those in front of us. But the main, we were all trawlers, and there was a senior officer of the trawlers, the one with the officer with the senior rank, and we just simply chugged on from the Clyde up to Reykjavik. Took about 5 or 6 days. We only had four or five ships in the convoy, only a small convoy.
Was the convoy attacked?
No.
Did you go ashore in Iceland?
Yes, oh yes. We went ashore in Iceland. Although the natives weren't friendly, they put up with us, should I say, and we used to buy things you couldn't get at home, like silk stockings and chocolate and ladies' underwear, things to take home.
In what way did the unfriendliness of the Icelanders show itself?
More in not taking much notice of us. I mean, you could imagine what it would be like if we, a load of foreigners came and invaded England. We wouldn't be very pleased about it, and that's what had happened up there, that we just simply stepped in and took over the place. We didn't interfere with their work. They kept on with the work, but... we were nevertheless quiet invaders, if you like. And so, apart from the few dock workers and people directly involved with us, the natives didn't have much truck with us anyway. Not that we were not unduly worried about that, because we'd also been told it would be unwise to have much truck with the natives because many of them had German sympathies and were quite capable of obtaining information to send back to Germany. So we just didn't bother with each other much.
But did they make any remarks or gesticulate?
Oh, no. We were greeted friendly but standoffish. We went to in the cafes and the cinema, the Bjor cinema, and up to the, we went in the swimming bath. The swimming baths are heated by natural hot water from the springs. Oh, no, we were able to go around where we wanted to, and nobody was offensive to us, no.
And then what happened to you after this?
Well, we came back from Iceland to the UK. And
so you went back to Belfast?
Yes, that's right.
What happened to you there?
Well, I went back to Belfast. Oh, we had on the 30th September, when we sailed from Iceland, arrived in Belfast on the 6th of October 1940, and we went into Belfast for a refit. We went into Harland and Wolff's yard, shipyard, and they, more or less stripped the ship out, sent all us ashore, and we were living in digs with an Irish family up Newtonards Road for five or six weeks. Living in these and going down to the ship each day, doing jobs, getting in the way of the dockers and so on, but nevertheless going down every day until the ship was made fit for sea again. They did a lot of improvements. They put us one or two extra guns on, and we had some extra crew. I lost my bunk in the wireless office and went down living in the forward mess deck, and we got another wireless operator on board, and we got a coder. Now coders were that was a new branch at the time, and we got a coder on board. Previously the wireless operator had been doing all the coding when it was necessary. So in our department with a new telegraphist making two of us. We also got a new signalman making two signalmen, and we got a coder. After the refit, we then went round to Londonderry. They were just opening up Londonderry as a base at that time, and we stayed in Londonderry quite a while, going in and out of Londonderry. It was 1st of December 1940, that we took our first convoy out, Atlantic convoys. And at that time, we used to go about less than halfway across the Atlantic. I think it was 12 or 14 degrees west. We used to take a convoy out, and the merchant ships used to carry on. We used to sort of scout round for an incoming convoy, and really an incoming convoy back, and we proceeded like that for the most, right up to February 1941. We did about four convoys in that way. There was one slight diversion in March. There was a ship called the Baltara, B-A-L-T-A-R-A, merchant ship. She was somewhere out in the Atlantic, a bit farther south than our normal route, and her engine had conked out. She was floating, unable to steam. So they sent us out to look for this Baltara, this steamer, and we found her after about a week. We found her just flopping about in the ocean. And she was, as I say, she was well south. The captain of the Baltara wanted to go to Madeira and to be towed to Madeira. We thought, lovely, we'd go to Madeira, but I had to send a signal, wireless signal, up to CNC Western Approaches, and await their instructions. And they said, no, you're coming back to the Clyde. So we had to hang about for another 3 or 4 days until a tug reached us and a corvette. They took over and we steamed back to Londonderry. Then we carried on with our convoys during April, May, June, July.
And all this time you hadn't run into the enemy?
I only ever saw one ship sunk in the, and it was during this period, one ship sunk in the North Atlantic, and we were homeward bound on a lovely summer's day, very calm weather, and a tanker was torpedoed and burst into flames. We weren't the nearest nearest trawler. There was another one nearer to us, and they went in and got some survivors off the ship. But that was the only one that I saw sunk in the North Atlantic, although there were a lot sunk, but we were fortunate in missing them, I suppose.
I think at this stage, perhaps we should say what the role of the St. Elston was in convoys, what job it was supposed to do.
Well, she was an ocean escort trawler. She was fitted with ASDIC gear for...
Don't worry about documents and so on.
She was fitted with ASDIC gear for detecting submarines. And she'd got a 4-inch gun forward for surface action. She'd got twin Lewis guns either side of the bridge. And she'd a twin gun, Lewis gun, aft, more or less just above the... it was on top of the galley, actually. And on each side, in midships, there were two depth charge throwers, and then on the stern there were two rails with about half a dozen depth charges in each sloping rail, and you just lifted a lever up and a depth charge rolled off after they'd been charged. So our prime job was protecting the convoy. And we used to drop... we used to have contacts, and we used to drop depth charges, and that was always an interesting operation, because at the speed... our top speed, flat out, was only about 12 knots. And if you dropped a pattern of depth charges... which might be a dozen or 18, we were hardly out of the danger area by the time the depth charges exploded. So more than one ship of ours has been damaged in the stern by its own depth charges, because the top speed was about 12 knots. The normal convoy speed in a slow convoy was 4 to 6 knots. In a fast convoy, it was probably 10 to 12 knots. We were mostly in slow convoys. In a fast convoy, we had to go like mad and couldn't do much zigzagging. And possibly the secondary consideration was rescue. If a ship was hit, torpedoed, then a trawler... or possibly a corvette, whoever was nearer, would be sent in to pick up survivors. And we came more into that role when we got up into the Arctic.
How would survivors be got on board?
Well, these trawlers, these ocean escort trawlers, they had a very low freeboard. They weren't very high out of the water. In the waist of the ship, the freeboard was very low. You could almost stretch over and touch the water, so low. So if we were doing a rescuing, we would have rope nets on each side of the ship rolled up inside, just inside, and if we're doing a rescue job, they'd tip them over with the netting down the outside of the ship, and then we'd go as close as we could to anyone in the water, and hopefully they'd be able to climb up the netting. And sometimes, of course, they were in lifeboats and could come alongside and virtually get on board us without getting the feet wet, but the netting was used to rescue those that were in the water. When they got on board, in the early stages, we hadn't any facilities for them. They just came and we gave them what spare clothes we had. They slept in our bunks when we were on watch and that sort of thing. And they had to dine with us down in the mess deck. We usually arranged it so that if there were many survivors, that they had their own sort of meal time, and whilst we were on watch, and then we came down, we had ours. It put a lot of pressure on the cook, of course, because we'd only one cook at that time. Well, we only ever had one cook, but we'd usually get one of the seamen to help him out. In the early stages, we had no cook at all. When we came out of Belfast after that refit, we had no cook as such. We'd no man rated as a cook. And at that time, our cook, and he was quite good, but he was a stoker. He was a stoker by trade, ex-merchant seaman. And he was designated cook. Another seaman was designated officer steward, because we hadn't been a steward with four officers, I think, then. And after that stoker left, we had to get another seaman volunteer to take the cooking on. And it'd probably be 1941, before we got a trained RN cook. And we also at that stage got a trained RN officer steward. But we fed up. The food was okay. It was mostly in tins. It was monotonous. It was mostly corned beef. What did you call them? They were tin fish in herrings. Herrings in tomato, in tin. And we did at one stage get these soya links. They were sausages made out of soya flour. And in the early stages, we didn't have a fridge on board, so we could only live for about 3 or 4 days off the meat that we could eat before it went bad. But again, after that refit in Belfast, it was, they'd put the fridge on board, so then we were able to keep the fresh meat a little bit longer.
Did you like the soya link?
Oh, yes. I thought it was all right. I liked the herrings in tomato and all. But some of the lads didn't. Yes, it was all right. It was a soya link. I never... Mind, I had that frame of mind, you see, that I would accept anything. I wasn't going to grumble because there wasn't any cream buns or something like that. This was what we had to do. We had to go to sea and stay there a long time and run short of food and meet bad weather. And it was all part of what I'd chosen to do. So I never grumbled about it.
And the accommodation on board?
Well, that was good. In fact, it was better than it was in the destroyers. In the forward mess deck, which was the fish hold in peacetime, we had bunks on all sides of the mess deck, and we had a big coal stove in the middle, and it was a coal burning ship, of course. So we were always warm. We always had plenty of coal. We get the coal stove red hot sometimes when we're going up in the Arctic, but it was comfortable. It was a little bit difficult. You had to get your food from the galley, which was aft, forward into the mess deck. And in bad weather, it used to be quite an effort to get it forward all in one piece. And sometimes it was cold by the time you got it into the mess deck. But that was just one of the things you had to put up with.
Now, just to come back to the narrative, you were telling me about the Atlantic convoys in the spring of 1941.
Well, we continued doing Atlantic convoys all through from 1941 right up to the end of 1941, we went into Belfast for another refit. We'd done more or less 12 months from October 40 to October 41. We went into Belfast for another refit. That wasn't a long one. It took about 3 weeks. And they replaced some of our things that had been damaged and renewed some of the articles. And at that time, we got another telegraphist. And we had three of us then. And we also got two more coders, three coders, and we got another signalman. So the signal branch then was three of each, three sparkers, three coders, three signalmen. And we were able to, from then on, able to keep continuous watch 24 hours a day, four on, eight off. There was somebody always on watch. And they put us some better wireless equipment in. They put us some high frequency transmitter and receiver in addition to the smaller one which we already had. So we sort of two sets of transmitting gear, and that's as much as they did there, I think, because I know in one of these trips, in 1941, with some atrocious weather, it was always bad, was the weather, nearly always, but with some atrocious weather, and sometimes we would lose a convoy, sometimes the convoy would have to heave to, and everybody was steaming head to wind for, I've been doing this for a week sometimes, and then sort ourselves out when the weather moderated. But with one particular convoy where it was out, I've never seen anything like it, never will do again. Waves. You could literally sail down one side and up the other side. You know, the size of the waves was tremendous. And the convoy had been all split up. We're on our own. And all night they were struggling to keep the ship afloat, really. I didn't realise this at the time. I was in the wireless office. But they were rolling about. And our captain, Lieutenant Butcher, Graham Butcher, he had to actually take the wheel of the trawler whilst the crew were trying to keep the deck clear, because up to that time we had two lifeboat platforms, and the lifeboats used to be swung outboard when we were at sea. Swung out, you know, the davits were twisted, swung out, so that the boats could be lowered into the sea quickly. Now, on this particular occasion, with it being such awful weather, and us and the ship rolling, one of the lifeboats was dipping into the sea every time she rolled. She shipped a load of water and filled the lifeboat, and eventually bent the davit, solid steel things they were, bent it over, and this boat was lying sort of angled to the sea and getting full of water every time the ship rolled, and it was getting dangerous. So dangerous that eventually they had to cut the lifeboat free and let it drift away. So that was another occasion where when we got back into harbour, the